This is Reclaiming Jane, an Austin podcast for fans on the margins.
I'm Lauren Weathers.
And I'm Emily Davis Hale.
And today, we're reading chapters 10 through 12 of Northanger Abbey through the theme of emotional control.
I've got to say, I was very gratified by the response to my Catherine Moreland is autistic TED talk.
I knew there would be people out there that agreed.
I feel so validated, especially by the person who tagged me in a tweet from months ago where they had made the same argument. We are on the same wavelength. Great minds think alike.
I had also already liked the tweet from the Reclaiming Jane podcast account. So amazing. It was a nice reminder.
So yes, thank you everyone who has sent messages of support, because Catherine Moreland is autistic. And I think we see just even more evidence of that in this section.
I was just about to say, I feel like we got more support for that theory in these three chapters, for sure.
I'm very excited. This is sure is something of a section, and what a lens to read it through of emotional control.
I think we got the perfect one.
Yeah, this is another example of times where our section really exemplifies the theme in its notable absence, which is a lot of fun for this one.
We will have much to discuss.
Oh, yes. Well, shall we go ahead and start recapping?
I do believe so.
All right. It's you up first.
Dun, dun, dun.
It'll be fine. Are you ready to tell us what happens in chapters 10 through 12 of Northanger Abbey?
I think so.
All right. On your mark, get set, go.
Catherine finally meets Miss Tilney, and she finally gets to dance with Henry Tilney. She is all a flutter, everything is great, and the two of them invite her to go on a walk with them the next day as long as it doesn't rain. Except for lo and behold, it rains. And so Catherine believes she's not going to go out with the Tilneys. She is scooped up by the odious John Thorpe and her brother and Isabella, and they convince her to go on a ride with them, but the Tilneys did come back for her, and so she's missed them and appears very rude, and she's on a tizzy the next day to make sure they know that it was a misunderstanding.
Very nice.
Ah, thank you.
You did better than I think I will, but that's okay.
I honestly, despite the fact that I just finished reading these chapters mere hours ago, literally had to think in the split second I had before the recap, like, oh God, what happened?
This is why I started taking notes. I don't trust my brain.
Okay. I hope you trust your notes, because you are now up.
All right.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 3, 2, 1.
All right, so they go to the theater and then to the pump room again, and Catherine finally talks to Miss Tilney more, who immediately clocks Catherine's crush on her brother. There is another dance where Catherine manages to dodge John Thorpe mostly, and then Tilney asks to dance with her, and Thorpe is irritating about it, and Tilney has opinions about that. And then she's supposed to go on a country walk with the Tilneys, but it rains, so the trio come and scoop her up again for another ride, but she spots the Tilneys walking, and then John is a dick about it, and then Mr. Tilney is surprisingly chill about the whole circumstance because he doesn't like John either.
Done. Excellent.
Yes, I barely made it.
You were able to provide more detail too.
Okay. And, you know, we fill in each other's gaps.
Exactly. But let's begin with Miss Tilney.
Let's begin with Miss Tilney. Well, do we want to begin with Miss Tilney? Because right at the top of our first chapter here, Isabella is, in my opinion, exemplifying a lack of emotional control.
Ooh, yes.
You were so right last episode when you said that she's the ADHD friend to Catherine's autistic friend, because she just bounces around and she is just rambling, rambling, rambling. And she says that she is quite wild with impatience to meet Mr. Tilney. And then she immediately is onto the topic of how well she and James Moreland get along. And our opinions were so exactly the same. It was quite ridiculous. There was not a single point in which we differed. And then goes on to say that Catherine would have made fun of her. And Catherine says, no, indeed, I should not, because Catherine is autistic and she never would have picked up on it. And Isabella says, oh, yes, you would indeed. I know you better than you know yourself. And she just like, this girl needs to slow down. I can only read her dialogue going at like 90 miles a minute now.
Like I said, the speech patterns, very similar to someone who has ADHD. And as someone who has been accused multiple times before of speaking entirely too quickly. I understand. I get it. There have been periods of time where I have to remind myself to speak at a normal speed, and I catch myself forgetting that on the podcast all the time, and I'm very sorry for those times when I speak at Isabella's speed and not at a normal human comprehension speed, because it makes sense to me, and I just don't realize that it does not always translate to normal hearing.
Yeah, also, like, I've definitely become habituated to the speed at which you speak because we've been friends for over a decade. So I'm sure there are things that I just don't catch too. I'm just like, yeah, that's just, I speak Lauren now. So yep.
It's necessary. That and following all of my different topic changes and jumps similar to Isabella.
Yep.
She also, God bless her, tells Catherine at the beginning of this ramble that she's only going to speak to Catherine the entire night. And then within what seems like 30 seconds, she talks the rest of the evening to James. She has said everything that she needs to say to Catherine, and now shiny new toy has caught her attention, and she's gone. She probably does not even remember declaring that she was only going to speak to Catherine.
Yeah, absolutely wild. So that was a fun and perfect way to open this section.
It really was. That was perfect.
But then we do get to move on to Miss Tilney.
And Miss Tilney is the opposite of Isabella in that she seems to have far more emotional control and also more emotional intelligence than both Isabella and Catherine.
Absolutely. Isabella obviously knows that Catherine has a crush on Mr. Tilney, but Miss Tilney is much more subtle about this knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And Miss Tilney also seems to be a bit more genuine than Isabella, or at least that's the way that the narration would like us to perceive her. One of the things that stood out before we get deep into the conversation with Catherine and Miss Tilney is the way that their conversation is described. So it says that they're not really saying anything that is important or particularly interesting. They're basically going through the same platitudes and niceties that everyone in Bath has exchanged. It's described as, "Not an observation was made, nor an expression used by either, which had not been made and used some thousands of times before, under that roof, in every bath season. Yet, the merit of their being spoken with simplicity and truth, and without personal conceit, might be something uncommon." So they genuinely are trying to be nice to one another, rather than having it be hidden under these multiple layers of conceit, or trying to get something else out of the other person through being seemingly nice. They're genuinely just trying to get to know one another.
Yeah, that is, at least I definitely appreciate that. And I doubt Catherine sees that, but I hope she can feel it too.
Exactly. Same.
I loved the little note as they are parting after their conversation that says, "They parted on Miss Tilney's side with some knowledge of her new acquaintance's feelings about her brother, and on Catherine's without the smallest consciousness of having explained them."
I also marked that passage, as well as Catherine asking Miss Tilney for her opinion of Miss Smith. So Catherine, again, does not really have the social graces to know how to make topic changes without making it very obvious what she's doing, which is why Miss Tilney can pick up on the fact that Catherine really likes her brother.
Because relatable.
Catherine introduces the subject by saying, "How well your brother dances."
Every time I try to change a topic in a conversation, I feel exactly like that.
Yeah,
like, I'm just gonna bumble my way into a new subject of conversation.
She doesn't quite know how to get at what she wants to talk about without making it very obvious, nor does she know that she's being obvious. And so then they engage in conversation, and Ms. Tilney is like, "Oh, you know, my brother," with a smile. "He does dance very well." And so Catherine eventually says, "You know, was not the young lady he danced with on Monday a Miss Smith?" And Miss Tilney says, "Yes, an acquaintance of Mrs. Hughes." And Catherine says, "I dare say she was very glad to dance. Do you think her pretty?" To which Miss Tilney responds, "Not very." Doesn't, just savage.
Mm-hmm.
"No, I don't. Let's move on."
Yeah.
But there is definitely a bit more emotional regulation coming from Miss Tilney's side. It's not a not very of frustration. It's simply a, I don't want to continue down this line of conversation.
Yeah. I know what answer you're looking for. I will just give it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Catherine is definitely not a paragon of emotional regulation, because for one, she completely gives away her feelings about Mr. Tilney to his sister. And then the evening when they go to the dance and he asks her to join him. It says, with what sparkling eyes and ready motion she granted his request, and with how pleasing a flutter of heart she went with him to the set may be easily imagined. She's just so delighted. She's so, her emotional regulation is just, well, I was going to say her emotional regulation is undone by this, but I don't think she even really has that much control over even what display of emotion she has. She's just such a young and carefree person. Her naivete has not built up those walls yet.
She wears her heart on her sleeve.
Absolutely. That's such a better way of putting it.
I think it can be an admirable quality to have, but when you're in a society like upper class England, where the social rules do not call for any kind of genuine expression of emotion, it can get you into trouble.
Mm-hmm. And there are definitely some genuine expressions of emotion during this dance, because John Thorpe just straight up tries to gaslight her, because he comes by as she's about to start dancing with Tilney and starts saying, like, Catherine, what happened? We were gonna dance. She's like, you never asked me. And he says, that is a good one, by Jove. I asked you as soon as I came into the room, and I was just going to ask you again, but when I turned around, you were gone. That's just straight up a lie, as far as we're aware.
Right, because we have explicitly been told that Catherine has been avoiding him this entire time, specifically because she does not want a repeat of what happened last time. When she was engaged by John Thorpe, she could not dance with Mr. Tilney, who she actually wanted to dance with, but John Thorpe has just ditched her and is off doing who knows what. And so she was forced to suffer the indignity of looking as though she'd not been asked to dance when really she was engaged. And she is determined that will not happen again. She will dance with Mr. Tilney if he asks her, but she has to make sure that she is available to be asked. So we know that John Thorpe has not asked her to stand up and dance with him, because she's specifically been avoiding that the entire time.
Mm-hmm. And he is just such a petty little child about it. Like, basically trying to talk her out of dancing with Tilney. She's like, I'm already busy. We're
in front of Tilney.
In front of Tilney, which Tilney is not happy about
at all. He is completely unimpressed. After John Thorpe also goes off, he asks Catherine who her partner is. She kind of introduces the two of them. And then he goes off on a completely different tangent about, oh, well, does he want a horse? Because I have a friend who will sell one. For X amount of money, you know, not good enough for me, but for, you know, a man like you, you should do blah, blah, blah. And goes on for a paragraph about, does Tilney want to buy this horse, until he's finally moved away by the necessity of the room and people getting ready to dance, to where Catherine and Mr. Tilney are finally left alone. But not of his own volition, mind you. He's like pushed away by the crowd.
Mm-hmm. ADHD does have genetic components. He's just got a much more obnoxious version than Isabella does. He's rude. He's
nastier
such
manners.
A rude person. Yes.
Yeah. No, he's
equally incapable of controlling his emotions. His emotions are just way uglier.
Bad energy.
Very bad energy. The vibe is off.
The vibes are off, man. Don't like John Thorpe at all.
Definitely not. And like, it's bad here, but oh boy, just wait.
And, you know, poor Catherine, once again, she finally gets her dance with Mr. Tilney. They, make a comment about how awful John Thorpe is. And then Henry's trying to guide the conversation away from John Thorpe into a conversation about them dancing. But Catherine's missing all the opportunities to, like, engage in playful banter with him, because she doesn't understand how not to be literal, which, again, is just lending credence to your argument.
It's just so autistic. Every page, there's something new.
You know, Tilney starts off with saying, the gentleman would have put me out of patience had he stayed with you half a minute longer. He has no business to withdraw the attention of my partner from me. We have entered into a contract of mutual agreeableness for the space of an evening, and all our agreeableness belongs solely to each other for that time. Nobody can fasten themselves in the notice of one without injuring the rights of the other. I consider a country dance as an emblem of marriage. Fidelity and complacence are the principal duties of both, and those men who do not choose to dance or marry themselves have no business with the partners or wives of their neighbors. So he's like very skillfully acknowledged the fact that John Thorpe is being an asshole, paid Catherine a compliment, and basically said, I would like to only pay attention to you for the rest of the night. To which Catherine's response is, but they are such very different things.
Girl, yeah.
Sweet baby angel.
It's called a metaphor.
Play along.
This just makes me even more concerned about her gothic novel reading. Like, I thought it was fine before, but now I'm like, ooh, honey, if you can't spot a literary device.
She's just there for the vibes.
Just there for the vibes.
Oh, my heart. He, you know, he keeps trying to come back to the, he's trying to lay out the groundwork for her to maybe get it. He keeps giving her an out, pretty much. And he says to which, when she says, but they're such very different things, he goes, oh, so you think they cannot be compared together? And she's saying, oh, well, to be sure not. People that marry can never part, but must go and keep house together. People that dance only stand opposite each other in a long room for half an hour.
If it wouldn't be the most horrendous sound, I would just bang my head on the table. Bless her heart.
This goes on for like 3 pages.
Yeah, it's very long. It's a very long scene and conversation of Tilney continually trying to like use his metaphor and have a nice conversation with Catherine, but she just doesn't get it.
She doesn't. And then he's trying to at least get her to say, I don't want to be with Mr. Thorpe at all. Like, at least say, I don't want to be dancing with him. I would just like to be dancing with you. And he's trying to kind of get at that. And he moves the conversation away from marriage by saying basically, oh, okay, well, if dancing is not like a marriage, then what reassurance do I have that you're not going to go back to that other guy? Because you're not committed to me, because we've established that a dance is not really a marriage. So in theory, okay, sure, you can go and dance with someone else. But like, should I be afraid then that you'll go and you'll dance with some other man? And Catherine's response is, Mr. Thorpe is such a very particular friend of my brother's that if he talks to me, I must talk to him again. But there are hardly 3 young men in the room besides him that I have any acquaintance with. And Henry goes, and is that to be my only security? Alas, alas.
Then I love that she says, nay, I am sure you cannot have a better. For if I do not know anybody, it is impossible for me to talk to them. And besides, I do not want to talk to anybody.
She finally has given him something on accident, mind you.
Completely on accident.
And it's honest, she really doesn't want to talk to anybody else, but she doesn't know enough of like the conversational dance to say like, oh no, you'd never have anything to worry about. The only person I have any eye for in the room is you. You know, like, it's not. It's
but
not
she's
there.
So literal.
Exactly. God bless her.
Sweet baby. Protect Catherine Morland.
But, you know, they eventually move on to discuss other topics. And by the end of the night, she is successfully not scared away the Tilneys to the point where they have invited her out to come on a country walk with them the next day. And Miss Tilney's parting words are, remember, noon tomorrow. So Catherine goes home, noon tomorrow, noon tomorrow, noon tomorrow. Okay, got it, noon.
And then it rains. She's going to the window all morning. It's overcast. She doesn't like the look of it. And of course, Mrs. Allen is no help at all. If someone says, oh, no, I think it'll clear up, she says, yeah, of course it'll clear up. If someone says, it's going to be raining all day, she's like, that's exactly what I thought, too. So, like, ma'am, absolutely not.
Completely noncommittal.
Mm-hmm. But eventually, it is raining at noon, and it's raining for the 15 minutes past and the 20 minutes past, and it's still raining when Catherine has finally given up hope that the Tilneys will come and walk. And then, eventually, the rain clears.
At half past 12.
At half past 12. Unfortunately, the first people to arrive are John Thorpe and Isabella and James, who once again rush in and just like kidnap Catherine, regardless of her plans. John is so horrendous this whole time. He's just such a bully.
He's awful.
He has decided that he's going to go for a drive and he's going to take Catherine with him. And she doesn't really have any choice in the matter.
And you're really correct in your use of the word kidnapping, because it's meant to be a play on the kidnapping trope in the gothic novels that Catherine reads all the time.
Perfect.
Like she's being kidnapped by John Thorpe and taken away from her gallant hero.
Mm-hmm.
But even Catherine's brother is getting sick of him, because John Thorpe is saying all these places that they're going to go that day. And it's like, oh, we're going all the way to Bristol and we're going to have a heavenly drive, blah, 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 blah. We shall drive directly to Clifton and dine there. And then as soon as dinner is over, if there's time for it, go on to King's Weston. And Catherine's brother is like, I doubt our being able to do so much. And Thorpe says, you croaking fellow.
Which is a very funny insult.
It is a funny insult. We shall be able to do ten times more. King's Weston, aye, and Blaise Castle too, and anything else we can hear of. But here your sister says she will not go. Mind you, Catherine is very excited by this mention of a castle. Here is where my book's footnotes are also very useful.
Mine too. I actually got a useful footnote.
Oh, good. Go for it.
Yeah. So mine says, Blaise Castle, built in 1766, is actually a private summer house, so Catherine's longing for medieval gloom would have been frustrated. Catherine, of course, is daydreaming wildly about wandering down dark halls with a single candelabra and running into a locked gate and just all of these fanciful things conjured up by her novels, when really it's just like another Georgian house.
It is a large circular room with three small towers around it. That is it.
She would be so disappointed, but they never make it there.
Shocker.
Shocker.
And, you know, before they've even really been able to get out of Bath on this journey to nowhere, because they're not able to make it to nearly as many of the places as John Thorpe had said that they were going to be able to, they run into, who do you know, but the Tilneys. And the only reason Catherine is persuaded to leave the house, because when they come to pick her up, she says, no, I'm previously engaged. I promised the Tilneys to go on a walk. Isabella says, oh, have you seen how much dirt is outside? You know, the rain has stirred up all this filth. There's no way you could possibly go on a walk and enjoy it. Come for a drive instead. And Catherine's like, no, you know, they said noon. I'm waiting to see if they're going to come by here. And Thorpe says, oh, well, what does Henry Tilney drive? Because of freaking course, that's what his first question is, as a way to like identify him. To which Catherine, of course, does not know. And he says, oh, well, I'm sure I saw him, you know, leaving with a woman next to him who must have been his sister. And so they've already left. You know, they're in a phaeton. They're gone. They've left Bath to go do whatever. And so Catherine's like, oh, well, if you saw them, then I guess maybe our plans aren't happening anymore. So maybe you're right in that I guess I should go, because maybe they also decided that it was too dirty. Or, you know, they did only say that we were going to go for a walk if it wasn't raining. And it did rain. So I guess maybe our plans are canceled. So fine, I guess I'll go. That dirty liar. They did not go anywhere.
He just completely lied, because as they're on their way out of town, they pass the Tilneys walking down the street. John friggin' Thorpe says, who was that girl who looked so hard as she went by? Who? Where? On the right-hand pavement. She must be almost out of sight now. Catherine looked round and saw Miss Tilney leaning on her brother's arm, walking slowly down the street. And so Catherine immediately realizes, oh no, there's been a mistake made, and tries to tell John to stop and that she will get out and she will go walk with the Tilneys and they can continue on, whatever. And he just absolutely refuses. And like, he's so mad about it. He laughs at her and he just like drives the horse on harder, and has absolutely no remorse about having straight up lied to Catherine. Like, I disliked him before. Now I'm actively worried about him.
He's the worst. And clearly willing to lie to get what he wants, mm-hmm. and has a controlling streak that's legit worrisome.
Yeah.
Like, that's the type of guy who you look at your friend and you say, oh, no, 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 run.
Yeah. This man has a temper that is not good to be around. He doesn't like to be contradicted. He wants to get what he wants immediately without fuss. And he's going to put up a ruckus if he doesn't.
And he continues gaslighting Catherine when she calls him out on it and says, how could you? You told me that they were leaving, but I've just seen them right there. And he says, it says, Thorpe defended himself very stoutly, declared he had never seen two men so much alike in his life and would hardly give up the point if it's having been Tilney himself. Which, of course, is a lie for multiple reasons, but also because he didn't recognize Miss Tilney. He says to Catherine, like, oh, who's that girl who's staring at you really hard? When, according to his own story that he told Catherine, he saw Mr. Tilney with a woman, and so he should have recognized who the girl was who was staring at Catherine quite hard if he really knew who she was.
Yep. So in the end, they don't get terribly far before James Moreland insists that they have to turn around. Like, they really haven't gone that far, but they just left too late in the day to really get anywhere significant. And John Thorpe is not happy about this. He says, "It is all one to me," replied Thorpe rather angrily, and just turned his horse around.
And he's also, he's cursing out Catherine's brother, like, "Oh, well, if he didn't have such a damned beast to drive, we might have done it very well. My horse would have trotted to Clifton within the hour if left to himself."
Shut up. Shut up. Leave her alone. Get out of here.
Even Catherine has had enough, and she doesn't speak more than 20 words to him the entire ride back. Mm-hmm. She's over it. She's so done.
And I do not blame her. But poor thing. When they get back, she finds that the Tilneys, or at least assuming the Tilneys, because they didn't have a card to leave, had called and asked after her, and she didn't leave a message for them or anything. She feels horrendous. She feels so bad. She thinks it's all completely her fault, when it's not. It's not. This is another thing, is that she feels all of the blame when she didn't actually do anything wrong. She acted on the information she had, and now, knowing that it was bad information, she thinks that she is to blame for this misunderstanding. And the chapter closes with, "Now I may dismiss my heroine to the sleepless couch, which is the true heroine's portion, to a pillow strewed with thorns and wet with tears, and lucky may she think herself if she get another good night's rest in the course of the next 3 months."
Tragic.
Absolutely tragic. I feel so bad for her.
And she also only missed them by like a couple of minutes, is what the footman says. Like, "Oh, right after you left," pretty much, they came by the house. So had she waited it out another 5-10 minutes, as she was so prone to do, she would have had her happy outing with the Tilneys.
Mm-hmm. But she wakes up the next morning filled with determination to go and make amends, to make things right with the Tilneys. She wants to go and call on Miss Tilney and apologize. She even manages to dodge the Thorpes on her way over when she is finding out their address from people in the pump room. But then gets there, and she's told that Miss Tilney's not there. But she can tell from the footman's voice that it's not quite the truth. And then as she's leaving, she looks back and sees Miss Tilney and her father walking out.
It's the equivalent of when you were a kid and you asked someone's parents if your friend was at home, but your friend was mad at you. And they're like, Bobby can't come play right now. But you know full well that Bobby's home. Yeah. He just told his parents, like, "Oh, no, I'm not here. Mm-hmm. Don't say anything."
Yeah. And she does later get the explanation from Henry Tilney, who is also at the theater, when he kindly comes over to speak with her. And it seems like he may have started in a bit of a short mood. But once she gives the explanation, he softens up a lot, presumably because he realizes that frickin' John Thorpe is the one who is actually behind it. And he tries to explain away, like, "Oh, no, it was all entirely my father's fault. They were about to go out and walk, and he didn't want to delay that for a few minutes." And Catherine is still a little on the fence about whether or not she believes this explanation, but it's good enough, and he seems to be in decent spirits with her. So,
but she still has one more thing that she wants to figure out. And she was so, so close to not having a literal Catherine conversation, because she then goes on to ask him. It says, "Catherine's mind was greatly eased by this information, yet a something of solicitude remained, from which sprang the following question, thoroughly artless in itself, though rather distressing to the gentleman. But Mr. Tilney, why were you less generous than your sister? If she felt such confidence in my good intentions and could suppose it to only be a mistake, why should you be so ready to take offense? Basically asking, why have you been looking at me with a sour face this entire time? Why were you more upset with me than your sister?" And I understand the impulse to want to know, but again, Catherine.
Yeah.
You can't just ask someone in Regency England, "Why are you mad at me?"
Yeah.
"And why were you less genuine than your sister?" You accept the fact that you smooth things over, mission accomplished, great, and then you move on. You're wonderful. Everyone's happy again now. You don't then reverse it and say, "But why were you mad at me?" But she doesn't know.
Yeah. Fortunately, Henry just, he lets it go and sort of brushes it off and says, "I wasn't mad at you. Which it seems like his feelings have been soothed. So mm-hmm. at this point, he's not mad at her. And then sits and talks about the play with her.
Like, honey, his feelings were hurt too.
Yeah.
And also, who should Catherine see but John Thorpe speaking to General Tilney, Henry and Miss Tilney's father. And she is so concerned because, number one, how are the two of them acquainted? Number two, it seems like they're looking at her, and she picks up on the fact that she thinks that they're discussing her, and she's like, oh, this can't be good. What on earth could they, what could they have to say? And she's reassured by John Thorpe, who, of course, makes a beeline to come find her after the play because she cannot get away from this man. And she asks him about it, and he says, oh, you know, I know him from this place in London. We play games together, whatever. And he also is, you know, making anti-Semitic comments again.
And seriously, this guy has got to go.
It's got to be done. And then he says, but what do you think we have been talking of? You, yes, by heavens. And the general thinks you the finest girl in Bath. And Catherine says, oh, nonsense. How can you say so? And John Thorpe says, and what do you think I said? Well done, General, said I. I'm quite of your mind.
I do not trust this at all. I feel like he is trying to head things off at the pass. He's trying to make the general think that he has a legitimate claim on Catherine's affections and potentially her hand so that the general will discourage his own son. There are machinations going on here. I don't trust it.
Something is amiss.
Something is afoot.
Something is afoot. And it's also worth noting that General Tilney had seen Catherine and Henry dancing at the ball a couple of nights ago. So perhaps at least he will have been able to see how happy Catherine was with him. Because it says that when he was looking at them, it was with kind of an approving look. And Catherine notices him staring and has to ask Henry who that is. And he goes, oh, that's my dad. But we shall see. General Tilney apparently is also quite handsome, according to Catherine.
Apparently, which is extremely funny.
She's like, oh, your dad is kind of hot, but I'm going to keep that to myself.
Just means that he'll age well.
Yeah.
Very funny. Oh my goodness. Yeah, the emotional control was non-existent. The emotions were flying all over the place.
From everyone.
From everyone.
And even Isabella, in the little intervals that we get with her, are basically just comments that exemplify how much she wants James to like her and how she will do anything to make sure that she stays in his good graces, including throwing Catherine under the bus. So her emotions equally unregulated.
Mm-hmm. Everyone is just such a mess. The Tilneys have it the most together, and even they have that slip where their disappointment in, not necessarily in Catherine, but their disappointment in missing Catherine and being slighted by Catherine, as far as they knew.
Yeah, it's quite clear.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
So deeply frustrating.
Entertaining for us as readers.
Oh, so entertaining.
But so distressing for Catherine.
Mm-hmm. But man, all I can think is of just a huge flashing danger warning sign around John Thorpe. That man is bad news.
Mm-hmm. A walking red flag.
Yes. Every single thing about him is a red flag.
Where's John Ralphio to sing that he's the worst?
Every time we mention John Thorpe, just imagine that that's what's playing in the background.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, please Google Jean Ralphio Parks and Recreation.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, just watch Parks and Recreation in general.
Yeah, please just watch Parks and Rec.
This is another one of the sections where we discuss the theme as we're discussing the events of the book. But was there anything else about emotional control that you wanted to touch on before we move on to historical topics?
I think we got it pretty well between, you know, Catherine's innocence leading to her lack of control and John Thorpe just never attempting to control his, Isabella's lack of control being kind of part and parcel of the rest of her personality, and then the Tilneys' apparent refinement also showing through in how comparatively restrained they seem to be.
I think that sums it up.
Great.
Wonderful. Then what do you have for us for historical topics today?
It's a little bit tangential to emotional control, but it dives right off of some commentary that was made fairly early in the section when Catherine is trying to decide what to wear. And the narration says that basically she's overthinking it because Man only can be aware of the insensibility of man towards a new gown. It would be mortifying to the feelings of many ladies could they be made to understand how little the heart of man is affected by what is costly or new in their attire. And it goes on a little bit more about how women are the only ones who really care about all of that, and neatness and fashion are enough for a man, basically. So I wanted to talk about the men for whom fashion was definitely extremely important, and touch a little bit on the concept of the Regency dandy.
Ooh, yay.
Yeah. So we're going to start a little bit further back than the Regency, back in the 1760s and that sort of third quarter of the 18th century, and the phenomenon of the macaroni, made famous for us Americans by Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Classic.
Yep. This was, in England at least, a phenomenon of often these very wealthy young men who go and travel Europe, you know, they do their grand tour, etc., and bring back just some really ostentatious, outrageous fashion trends. Because English fashions tended toward the moderate in this period, especially compared with typical like French or Italian wear. The macaroni was at least stereotyped as indulging in very leisurely lifestyles. They were gambling, they were partying, but they were not part of standard fashion trends in England, and they were pretty widely mocked for that, especially because a lot of their focus on fashion itself was seen as very effeminate. So,
shocker.
I know. Patriarchy and misogyny have always been a thing. Amazing. Who would have known? But the French imports in fashion and taste changed very drastically in the 1790s. Gee, I wonder why. It was the French Revolution.
What?
Yeah. And so even upper class fashion started tending more towards working class modes of dress. Even upper class men were adopting things like trousers. There was definitely very clear stratification in fashions between classes, but the upper classes were emulating in, you know, to higher standards, more of the styles that the lower classes might wear.
You know what that reminds me of?
Mm-hmm.
The Golden Goose sneakers that look like they've been beaten to hell. They look like a pair of beaten up Converse, but they cost $500. Those are a status symbol. But when you purchase them, they look like they've already been worn.
Mm-hmm. It's like ripped jeans.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, the dandy style, even in the period, there was nothing really like cohesive that said like, this is a dandy. It was just sort of generally a class of fashion conscious men, especially, who were, again, very widely mocked, like the macaroni. The dandy fashion style was sort of lumped in together with lifestyle and behavior that were kind of key parts of that image, exemplified very famously by Beau Brummel, who was part of the social circle of the Prince of Wales at the time, and today is often incorrectly credited with, like, making men's fashion boring. That's not a thing. I'm grateful to the historians and costumers that I have seen talking about this issue and being deeply frustrated with that myth that Beau Brummel is the one who, like, invented the three-piece suit or, like, made fashion boring. No. Styles were already in flux. He was exemplifying the dandy image. He was very fashion conscious. The idea, fashion-wise, was that you wanted to dress so perfectly that you did not stand out at all. It wasn't necessarily boring, but it was very exacting and right at the peak of fashion. But as I said earlier, behavior was also a big part of this. It was not just about the clothes you were wearing, it was about the person wearing the clothes. So you were expected to be witty and full of cutting remarks, just like ready to banter at a moment's notice. Again, class-associated gentlemanly behavior. But effeminacy was, again, a very commonly mocked feature of the dandy because, you know, being associated with any kind of feminine trait is a bad thing if you're a man, regardless of class. They were assumed to be very self-obsessed and image-obsessed. They had a, or were expected to have a superior attitude and to be really condescending in the negative sense toward others. But people of lower classes who took on dandy styles had some more of the brunt of this criticism because, you know, certain levels of arrogance are a lot more accepted among upper classes. Like Mr. Darcy, he, aside from, you know, things that happened with Elizabeth Bennet, like his arrogance isn't necessarily like, he's not necessarily mocked for that among people of his own class. But it is a kind of behavior that would get you ostracized in middle and lower classes. So yeah, we've got a little emotional control, or lack thereof. We've got some stereotypes, we've got a little bit of fashion, and that's a dandy.
Excellent blend. Well done.
Thank you.
I can't believe we haven't really gone into depth in to a Regency dandy until this point in time.
Yeah, I wish I could have found more, but as always, I'm working on a timeline for this and only have a couple of hours to do what research I can. But yeah, for anyone who's interested specifically in like Beau Brummel and that myth of him making fashion boring, Nicole Rudolph has an excellent YouTube video about like what was actually going on with trends in men's fashion. So highly recommend that. It's like 30 minutes long or something, but she's like a historian, knows what she's talking about.
Awesome. Thank you.
What do you have for pop culture today?
So I specifically wanted to do something with female friendships and communication and the kind of doublespeak that happens when you are in sometimes a surface level friendship between two women, and specifically thinking about the ways that Catherine and Isabella do or don't communicate, and then also just the kind of layered communication that was very prevalent in England at the time, and you know, still is to an extent, where you say not necessarily directly what you mean. You say it in a more oblique manner to get your point across. And because of Catherine's complete inability to do this, it's highlighted more than it would be in other books. And so what I wanted to do for my pop culture connection is to read a selection of passages from Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay.
Ooh, excellent.
Because in her book, which is a collection of nonfiction essays, she has a piece entitled How to Be Friends with Another Woman. So I pulled out a few that I thought would be applicable to Catherine and to Isabella, or that just might be helpful to Catherine as she tries to navigate Regency England.
This is now a self-help podcast specifically for Catherine Morland.
Right, exactly. This is an advice podcast for fictional characters now.
I mean, we do that sometimes.
We do that. Usually just on very special episodes. But today, you know, you get a 2-for-1 special. So I won't read the entire thing just for brevity's sake, but I have selected a few that I thought would be funny. So, number one, abandon the cultural myth that all female friendships must be bitchy, toxic, or competitive. This myth is like heels and purses, pretty but designed to slow women down. 1A, this is not to say women aren't bitches or toxic or competitive sometimes, but rather to say that these are not defining characteristics of female friendship, especially as you get older. 1B, if you find that you are being bitchy, toxic, or competitive towards the women who are supposed to be your closest friends, look at why and figure out how to fix it, and or find someone who can help you fix it. Isabella. Number 2. A lot of ink is given over to mythologizing female friendships as curious, fragile relationships that are always intensely fraught. Stop reading writing that encourages this mythology. At Catherine. Number 4. Sometimes your friends will date people who you cannot stand. You can either be honest about your feelings or you can lie. There are good reasons for both. Sometimes you will be the person dating someone your friends cannot stand. If your man or woman is a scrub, just own it so you and your friends can talk about more interesting things. My go-to explanation is, I am dating an asshole because I'm lazy. You are welcome to borrow it. Number 5. Want nothing but the best for your friends, because when your friends are happy and successful, it's probably going to be easier for you to be happy. I feel like Isabella could stand to remember this.
Yeah, definitely.
Catherine wants nothing for the best for her friends at all times. Isabella, on the other hand, debatable. 5A, if you're having a rough go of it and a friend is having the best year ever and you need to think some dark thoughts about that, do it alone, with your therapist, or in your diary so that when you actually see your friend, you can avoid the myth discussed in item one. 5B, if you and your friends are in the same field and you can collaborate or help each other, do this without shame. It's not your fault. Your friends are awesome. Men invented nepotism and practically live by it. It's okay for women to do it too. 5C, don't tear other women down, because even if they're not your friends, they are women, and this is just as important. This is not to say you can't criticize other women, but understand the difference between criticizing constructively and tearing down cruelly. 5D, everybody gossips. So if you're going to gossip about your friends, at least make it fun and interesting. As a corollary, never say, I never lie or I never gossip, because you are lying. Number 6, tell your friends the hard truths they need to hear. They might get pissed about it, but it's probably for their own good. Once, my best friend told me to get my love life together and demanded an action plan, and it was irritating, but also useful.
An action
plan. An action plan.
Wow.
I would like a 3-step plan for how you are going to get it together and pull your love life out of the gutter.
Number 1, ditch John Thorpe for good.
6A, don't be totally rude about truth-telling, and consider how much truth is actually needed to get the job done. Finesse goes a long way. That could apply to both of them, but Catherine, I love you so much. These conversations are more fun when preceded by an emphatic girl. Okay, 2 more. Number 10, when something is wrong and you need to talk to your friends and they ask you how you are, don't say fine. They know you're lying and it irritates them, and a lot of time is wasted with the back and forth of, are you sure, and yes, and really, and I am fine. Tell your lady friends the truth so you can talk it out and either sulk companionably or move on to other topics. And then finally, number 13, I will ask you to read this because I cannot read French and I don't want to sound ridiculous on the podcast.
God, okay.
Your accent is better than mine.
Disclaimer, I haven't taken French in 10 years.
But you've taken French and I have not.
Okay. Number 13, my mother's favorite saying is, qui se ressemble s'assemble. Apologies to actual French speakers. Whenever she didn't approve of who I was spending time with, she'd say this ominously. It means, essentially, you are whom you surround yourself with.
The end. That is my pop culture connection for today. If you have never read Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay, I implore you to please read the entire book. I didn't even get to read all the passages in this specific essay, but they are all filled with insight and humor and just wonderful takes on both pop culture and feminism, and would highly recommend whether or not you are applying her truths and advice to fictional characters or to your own life.
Thank you so much for bringing that in.
You are so welcome. It was wonderful to have another excuse to pick up the book again. And I hope that Isabella can take some of that to heart from the fictional pages of the 19th century.
Absolutely.
I think that brings us to the end.
I think it does.
All right. I recapped first, so it is your final takeaway.
All right. I think my final takeaway is that sometimes a lack of emotional control can be a boon in that you learn very quickly the character of the people around you, thinking especially of John Thorpe, because that man's not hiding anything.
At all. And Catherine's better off for it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's my takeaway.
I like that.
There's a lot of nuance that could be added to it, but this is pithy. Let's move on. What is your final takeaway, Lauren?
Honestly, I think my final takeaway is to say what you mean and to mean what you say, which, again, it's a pithy little platitude, but platitudes become platitudes because there's an element of truth to them. And I think that works out in Catherine's favor when she's speaking to Henry Tilney. So similarly, like, her lack of emotional control means that Henry believes her when she's saying very earnestly that she really wanted to just be spending time with them and she would have jumped from the carriage if she could and da-da-da. And while sometimes Catherine believing that everyone just saying what they mean gets her into trouble, it's not because she's wrong. It's because other people aren't communicating the way that she is. And I personally would rather communicate with Catherine's style of just saying what it is that you mean and then actually meaning what you say.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot. Well, that wraps up our takeaways, so it's time to draw a tarot card for next time. All right. Our card is Five of Clubs, the Devil.
Oh!
There is a gentleman in a red coat on this card who I suspect is Mr. Wickham.
Oh, well done.
Thank you.
Five of Clubs slash the Devil is temptation. And the description is, Mr. Wickham selfishly seduces Georgiana Darcy and Lydia Bennet in Pride and Prejudice.
The Devil and temptation.
Whatever shall we do with this? Thank you for joining us in this episode of Reclaiming Jane. Next time, we'll be reading chapters 13 through 15 of Northanger Abbey through the lens of temptation.
To read our show notes and a transcript of this episode, check out our website, reclaimingjanepod.com, where you can also find the full back catalog and links to our social media.
If you'd like to support us and gain access to exclusive content, you can join our Patreon at Reclaiming Jane Pod.
Reclaiming Jane is produced and co-hosted by Lauren Weathers and Emily Davis Hale. Our music is by Latasha Bundy and our show art is by Emily Davis Hale.
We'll see you next time, nerds.
Girl.
These conversations are more fun when preceded by an emphatic girl.
Well, now how am I supposed to cut that bump out?
You don't have to, but because it'll read the same either way, it just won't be as funny.